Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau from Compassionate Cooks. I founded Compassionate Cooks to empower people to make informed food choices and to debunk myths about vegetarianism and animal rights. I encourage you to check out CompassionateCooks.com, to check out our new Compassionate Cooks Club, to order our cookbooks, The Joy of Vegan Baking, The Vegan Table, to connect with other podcast listeners, and to just find lots of resources and recipes and information about living a compassionate, healthful life. Hi, everybody. I hope you're all doing well out there. First, I'd like to thank some supporters of the podcast and Compassionate Cooks. Charles Tsai is a longtime supporter from Vancouver, British Columbia, and he's an all-around great guy and activist. I mentioned and thanked him in a previous episode, which I think was a couple years ago now, so his name might sound familiar to you. He's the founder of the Global Youth Fund, which is a Canadian charity that provides young people with training and support to become effective leaders in the world. They've got some really wonderful projects going on their website, and I encourage you to check them out. Charles did not ask me to say any of this, but I want to honor the work that he does in this world. And so I encourage you to check out globalyouthfund.org. So thank you, Charles, for who you are and for all you do and for all your support. I'm so very grateful and I really appreciate it. I also want to thank Sherry Morgado. Sherry wrote to me first early in 2009, and then she wrote again in mid-2009. And here's what she had to say in the second email. I first wrote to you a brief email a few months ago, and since that time, I have been meaning to do something very important, which is to become a podcast sponsor. I just completed my transaction with PayPal, and that feels great. There are simply not enough superlatives in the English language to describe how deeply your incredible work has touched and changed my life. My 46th birthday is next week on May 1st, and I decided the best way to celebrate my birthday was to finally sponsor your podcast, which has given me so much joy and support. I think I have finally downloaded almost all the topics, and I listen to you each day when I go on my walk. Hearing your voice as I walk is like having my best vegan friend next to me, giving me support and encouragement. Your insights are intelligent and moving. I feel renewed each time I listen to you and more committed to this path than ever. I'm approaching my 6-month vegan anniversary now, and I couldn't be happier. It feels like the first 45 years were a long journey to get here. But now it almost feels like I've been vegan my entire life. I just know that the next 45 years living in this compassionate and joyful way are going to be the very best of my life. Sherry also shared with me some really lovely experiences, incredible breakthroughs that people around her are having ever since she became vegan. She goes on, I couldn't agree more when you talk about how important it is to speak our truth, as this may be just the opportunity for the person we're talking with to have their breakthrough as well, and that we don't give people around us credit for having the desire and ability to change. I've learned from my experiences to truly never say never. So Colleen, thank you from the bottom of my heart. You are a healing force in this world, so desperately in need of compassion and peace. Thank you, Sherry. Keep up the awesome work. I know you're spreading your seeds and doing some great work out there, and keep speaking your truth on behalf of the animals. I'm eternally grateful. The support from the podcast listeners and the Compassionate Cooks Club members is vital to the work that I do, and if it weren't for all of you, I don't know what I would do. If you'd like to support the work of Compassionate Cooks and help keep this podcast going, I hope you'll consider becoming a member of our Compassionate Cooks Club. I have a special episode where I talk all about it. I created it as a way to include everyone into the Compassionate Cooks family, and I'm really excited about the response so far. In fact, you can even check out our new page of special members. Go under About in the toolbar at CompassionateCooks.com, and you can see special members there, which is really awesome. There are lots of perks and benefits and discounts depending on the level you choose. You can become an annual member or a monthly member. So check out CompassionateCooks.com. Click on the buttons that encourage you to join the club. And thank you very much. You're all awesome. Whether you're a member or not, you're all awesome. And I'm thrilled to be sharing my life's work with such amazing, receptive people. Whoever said people don't change clearly didn't know people. So anyway, it's time to get to our story, a very special story indeed. It feels like a very long time since I've read a short story, and I apologize. I tucked this one way far away into the far reaches of my mind, and now I've pulled it out, and I can't wait to share it with you. I know I've said this to you before, but it's really an incredible joy and pleasure for me. It's incredibly satisfying for someone who has had literature as the foundation, really, of all of my education, find so many literary gems centered around our consciousness or lack of consciousness of animals and our relationship to non-human animals written by really good, really well-regarded, critically and popularly acclaimed writers. It's so satisfying for me. And the only reason I haven't compiled them into an anthology yet is because I keep finding new ones. So I realize that we're just going to have several volumes of these anthologies, and just know it's on my list. And you should know by now that if I say I'm going to do something, I do it. So it is definitely a plan of mine to have these short stories that I've been reading on this podcast in one anthology or several volumes of an anthology. So our story today, and its author would most definitely be part of this anthology, it's a short story called A Dog's Tale. Maybe you're familiar with it. It's written by none other than Mark Twain. Now, I know y'all don't need an introduction to Mark Twain, born Samuel Langhorne Clemens in 1835. Twain, or Clemens, first gained national attention as a humorist in 1865 with the publication of The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. You may have heard of that. But he was acknowledged as a great writer by the literary establishment with The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, and that was in 1885. In addition to novels, he wrote memoirs, critical essays, literary reviews, short stories, satires, articles, and his own autobiography. In addition to being a writer, or part and parcel to it, he was a social critic. He held strong political views, and he did not hesitate to share them. The most important of these views, to my mind, was his support of the abolition of slavery, the emancipation of the slaves. He was a supporter of women's rights and women's suffrage, and he was opposed to vivisection. He was opposed to animal research. And in fact, Twain was an avid supporter of animal advocacy, and he spoke openly about his anti-vivisection stance. He's quoted as saying, "I'm not interested to know whether vivisection produces results that are profitable to the human race. The pains which it inflicts upon unconsenting animals is the basis of my enmity towards it." Pretty flippin' cool, if you ask me. So that was his position on vivisection. And in 1903, he published the short story, A Dog's Tale, in the Christmas edition of Harper's Monthly magazine. And the following year, it was released as a book published by Harper and Brothers. Though it tends to be overshadowed by his more famous works, the story did receive public and critical acclaim at the time. And as Diane Beers writes in For the Prevention of Cruelty, it is, quote, to this day, a persuasive literary weapon for animal advocacy. And I also agree with her when she writes, Twain's deceptively simple little tale gave a powerful voice to the voiceless and laid bare human cruelty and arrogance, and still does. It's pretty lovely. It's very sad, I have to warn you. But I believe it's a necessary story to read, and it's a finely written one. And no doubt the first sentence will be familiar to you. So let's get started and read A Dog's Tale by Mark Twain. My father was a Saint Bernard, my mother was a collie, but I am a Presbyterian. This is what my mother told me. I do not know these nice distinctions myself. To me, they are only fine, large words meaning nothing. My mother had a fondness for such. She liked to say them and see other dogs look surprised and envious, as wondering how she got so much education. But indeed, it was not real education. It was only show. She got the words by listening in the dining room and drawing room when there was company, and by going with the children to Sunday school and listening there. And whenever she heard a large word, she said it over to herself many times, and so she was able to keep it until there was a dogmatic gathering in the neighborhood. Then she would get it off and surprise and distress them all, from pocket pup to mastiff, which rewarded her for all her trouble. If there was a stranger, he was nearly sure to be suspicious, and when he got his breath again, he would ask her what it meant. And she always told him. He was never expecting this, but thought he would catch her. So when she told him, he was the one that looked ashamed, whereas he had thought it was going to be she. The others were always waiting for this, and glad of it and proud of her, for they knew what was going to happen because they had had experience. When she told the meaning of a big word, they were all so taken up with admiration that it never occurred to any dog to doubt if it was the right one. And that was natural because, for one thing, she answered up so promptly that it seemed like a dictionary speaking. And for another thing, where could they find out whether it was right or not? For she was the only cultivated dog there was. By and by, when I was older, she brought home the word unintellectual one time and worked it pretty hard all the week at different gatherings, making much unhappiness and despondency. And it was at this time that I noticed that during that week, she was asked for the meaning at 8 different assemblages and flashed out a fresh definition every time, which showed me that she had more presence of mind than culture, though I said nothing, of course. She had one word which she always kept on hand and ready like a life preserver, a kind of emergency word to strap on when she was likely to get washed overboard in a sudden way. That was the word synonymous. When she happened to fetch out a long word which had had its day weeks before and its prepared meanings gone to her dump pile, if there was a stranger there, of course it knocked him groggy for a couple of minutes, then he would come to, and by that time she would be away down the wind on another tack and not expecting anything, so when he'd hail and ask her to cash it in, I, the only dog on the inside of her game, could see her canvas flicker a moment, but only just a moment. Then it would belly out, taut and full, and she would say, as calm as a summer's day, "It's synonymous with supererogation," or some godless long reptile of a word like that, and go placidly about and skim away on the next tack, perfectly comfortable, you know, and leave that stranger looking profane and embarrassed, and the initiated slatting the floor with their tails in unison and their faces transfigured with a holy joy. She would drag home a whole phrase if it had a grand sound and play it 6 nights and 2 matinees and explain it a new way every time. Which she had to, for all she cared for was the phrase. She wasn't interested in what it meant, and knew those dogs hadn't wit enough to catch her anyway. Yes, she was a daisy. She got so she wasn't afraid of anything. She had such confidence in the ignorance of those creatures. She even brought anecdotes that she had heard the family and the dinner guests laugh and shout over, and as a rule, she got the nub of one chestnut hitched onto another chestnut where, of course, it didn't fit and hadn't any point. And when she delivered the nub, she fell over and rolled on the floor and laughed and barked in the most insane way, while I could see that she was wondering to herself why it didn't seem funny as it did when she first heard it. But no harm was done. The others rolled and barked too, privately ashamed of themselves for not seeing the point and never suspecting that the fault was not with them and there wasn't any to see. You can see by these things that she was of a rather vain and frivolous character. Still, she had virtues and enough to make up, I think. She had a kind heart and gentle ways and never harbored resentments for injuries done her, but put them easily out of her mind and forgot them. And she taught her children her kindly way, and from her we learned also to be brave and prompt in time of danger, and not to run away, but face the peril that threatened friend or stranger, and help him the best we could without stopping to think what the cost might be to us. And she taught us not by words only, but by example, and that is the best way, and the surest, and the most lasting. Why, the brave things she did, the splendid things. She was just a soldier, and so modest about it. Well, you couldn't help admiring her, and you couldn't help imitating her. Not even a King Charles Spaniel could remain entirely despicable in her society. So as you see, there was more to her than her education. When I was well grown at last, I was sold and taken away, and I never saw her again. She was broken-hearted, and so was I, and we cried. But she comforted me as well as she could, and said we were sent into this world for a wise and good purpose, and must do our duties without repining, take our life as we might find it, live it for the best good of others, and never mind about the results. They were not our affair. She said men who did like this would have a noble and beautiful reward by and by in another world, and although we animals would not go there, to do well and right without reward would give to our brief lives a worthiness and dignity which in itself would be a reward. She had gathered these things from time to time when she had gone to the Sunday school with the children and had laid them up in her memory more carefully than she had done with those other words and phrases, and she had studied them deeply, for her good and ours. One may see by this that she had a wise and thoughtful head, for all there was so much lightness and vanity in it. So we said our farewells and looked our last upon each other through our tears, and the last thing she said, keeping it for the last to make me remember it the better, I think, was, "In memory of me, when there is a time of danger to another, do not think of yourself, think of your mother and do as she would do." Do you think I could forget that? No. It was such a charming home, my new one. A fine, great house with pictures and delicate decorations and rich furniture and no gloom anywhere, but all the wilderness of dainty colors lit up with flooding sunshine and the spacious grounds around it and the great garden, oh, greensward, and noble trees and flowers, no end. And I was the same as a member of the family, and they loved me and petted me and did not give me a new name, but called me by my old one that was dear to me because my mother had given it to me. Aileen Mavourneen. She got it out of a song, and the Greys knew that song, and it said it was a beautiful name. Mrs. Grey was 30, and so sweet and so lovely, you cannot imagine it. And Sadie was 10, and just like her mother, just a darling, slender little copy of her, with auburn tails down her back and short frocks. And the baby was a year old, and plump and dimpled, and fond of me, and never could get enough of hauling on my tail and hugging me and laughing out its innocent happiness. And Mr. Grey was 38, and tall and slender and handsome, a little bald in front, alert, quick in his movements, businesslike, prompt, decided, unsentimental, and with that kind of trim, chiseled face that just seems to glint and sparkle with frosty intellectuality. He was a renowned scientist. I do not know what the word means, but my mother would know how to use it and get effects. She would know how to depress a rat terrier with it and make a lap dog look sorry he came. But that was not the best one. The best one was laboratory. My mother could organize a trust on that one that would skin the tax collars off the whole herd. The laboratory was not a book or a picture or a place to wash your hands in, as the college president's dog said. No. That is the laboratory. The laboratory is quite different and is filled with jars and bottles and electrics and wires and strange machines. And every week, other scientists came there and sat in the place and used the machines and discussed and made what they called experiments and discoveries. And often I came too and stood around and listened and tried to learn for the sake of my mother and in loving memory of her, although it was a pain to me as realizing what she was losing out of her life and I gaining nothing at all. For try as I might, I was never able to make anything out of it at all. Other times I lay on the floor in the mistress's workroom and slept, she gently using me for a footstool, knowing it pleased me, for it was a caress. Other times I spent an hour in the nursery and got well tousled and made happy. Other times I watched by the crib there when the baby was asleep and the nurse out for a few minutes on the baby's affairs. Other times I romped and raced through the grounds and the garden with Sadie till we were tired out, then slumbered on the grass in the shade of a tree while she read her book. Other times I went visiting among the neighbor dogs, for there were some most pleasant ones not far away, and one very handsome and courteous and graceful one, a curly-haired Irish setter by the name of Robin Adar. He was a Presbyterian like me and belonged to the Scotch minister. The servants in our house were all kind to me and were fond of me, and so, as you see, mine was a pleasant life. There could not be a happier dog than I was, nor a gratefuler one. I will say this for myself, for it is only the truth. I tried in all ways to do well and right and honor my mother's memory and her teachings and earn the happiness that had come to me as best I could. By and by came my little puppy, and then my cup was full. My happiness was perfect. It was the dearest little waddling thing, and so smooth and soft and velvety, and had such cunning little awkward paws, and such affectionate eyes, and such a sweet and innocent face, and it made me so proud to see how the children and their mother adored it and fondled it, and exclaimed over every little wonderful thing it did. It did seem to me that life was just too lovely to... Then came the winter. One day I was standing a watch in the nursery, that is to say, I was asleep on the bed. The baby was asleep in the crib, which was alongside the bed on the side next to the fireplace. It was the kind of crib that has a lofty tent over it made of a gauzy stuff that you could see through. The nurse was out, and we two sleepers were alone. A spark from the wood fire was shot out, and it lit on the slope of the tent. I suppose a quiet interval followed, then a scream from the baby woke me, and there was that tent flaming up toward the ceiling. Before I could think, I sprang to the floor in my fright, and in a second was halfway to the door. But in the next half second, my mother's farewell was sounding in my ears, and I was back on the bed again. I reached my head through the flames and dragged the baby out by the waistband and tugged it along, and we fell to the floor together in a cloud of smoke. I snatched a new hold and dragged the screaming little creature along and out the door and around the bend of the hall, and was still tugging away, all excited and happy and proud, when the master's voice shouted, "Begone, you cursed beast!" And I jumped to save myself. But he was wonderfully quick and chased me up, striking furiously at me with his cane. I dodged this way and that in terror, and at last a strong blow fell upon my left foreleg, which made me shriek and fall, for the moment, helpless. The cane went up for another blow, but never descended, for the nurse's voice rang wildly out, "The nursery's on fire!" And the master rushed away in that direction, and my other bones were saved. The pain was cruel, but no matter, I must not lose any time. He might come back at any moment. So I limped on three legs to the other end of the hall, where there was a dark little stairway leading up to a garret where old boxes and such things were kept, as I heard say, and where people seldom went. I managed to climb up there. Then I searched my way through the dark among the piles of things and hid in the secretest place I could find. It was foolish to be afraid there, yet still I was so afraid that I held in and hardly even whimpered, though it would have been such a comfort to whimper, because that eases the pain, you know. But I could lick my leg, and that did me some good. For half an hour there was a commotion downstairs and shoutings and rushing footsteps, and then there was quiet again. Quiet for some minutes, and that was grateful to my spirit, for then my fears began to go down, and fears are worse than pains, oh, much worse. Then came a sound that froze me. They were calling me by my name, hunting for me. It was muffled by distance, but that could not take the terror out of it, and it was the most dreadful sound to me that I had ever heard. It went all about, everywhere, down there, along the halls, through all the rooms, in both stories, and in the basement and the cellar, then outside, and further away, then back, and all about the house again, and I thought it would never, never stop. But at last it did, hours and hours after the vague twilight of the garret had long ago been blotted out by black darkness. Then, in that blessed stillness, my terror fell little by little away, and I was at peace and slept. It was a good rest I had, but I woke before the twilight had come again. I was feeling fairly comfortable, and I could think out a plan now. I made a very good one, which was to creep down all the way down the back stairs and hide behind the cellar door and slip out and escape when the iceman came at dawn while he was inside filling the refrigerator. Then I would hide all day and start on my journey when night came, my journey to, well, anywhere where they would not know me and betray me to the master. I was feeling almost cheerful now. Then I suddenly thought, why, what would life be without my puppy? That was despair. There was no plan for me. I saw that. I must stay where I was, stay and wait and take what might come. It was not my affair. That was what life is. My mother had said it. Then, well, then the calling came back again. All my sorrows came back. I said to myself, the master will never forgive. I did not know what I had done to him to make him so bitter and so unforgiving. Yet I judged it was something a dog could not understand, but which was clear to a man and dreadful. They called and called, days and nights, it seemed to me, so long that the hunger and thirst near drove me mad, and I recognized that I was getting very weak. When you are this way, you sleep a great deal, and I did. Once I woke in an awful fright. It seemed to me that the calling was right there in the garret, and so it was. It was Sadie's voice, and she was crying. My name was falling from her lips, all broken, poor thing, and I could not believe my ears for the joy of it when I heard her say, come back to us and forgive. It is all so sad without our... I broke in with such a grateful little yelp, and the next moment Sadie was plunging and stumbling through the darkness and the lumber and shouting for the family to hear, she's found, she's found. The days that followed, well, they were wonderful. The mother and Sadie and the servants, why, they just seemed to worship me. They couldn't seem to make me a bed that was fine enough, and as for the food, they couldn't be satisfied with anything but game and delicacies that were out of season, and every day the friends and neighbors flocked in to hear about my heroism. That was the name they called it by, and it means agriculture. I remember my mother pulling it on a kennel once and explaining it that way, but didn't say what agriculture was, except that it was synonymous with intramural incandescence. And a dozen times a day, Mrs. Gray and Sadie would tell the tale to newcomers and say I risked my life to save the babies, and both of us had burns to prove it. And then the company would pass me around and pet me and exclaim about me, and you could see the pride in the eyes of Sadie and her mother. And when the people wanted to know what made me limp, they looked ashamed and changed the subject. And sometimes when people hunted them this way and that way with questions about it, it looked to me as if they were going to cry. And this was not all the glory, no. The master's friends came, a whole 20 of the most distinguished people, and had me in the laboratory and discussed me as if I was a kind of discovery. And some of them said it was wonderful in a dumb beast, the finest exhibition of instinct they could call to mind. But the master said with vehemence, it's far above instinct, it's reason, and many a man privileged to be saved and go with you and me to a better world by right of its possession has less of it than this poor silly quadruped that's foreordained to perish. And then he laughed and said, why, look at me, I'm a sarcasm. Bless you with all my grand intelligence. The only thing I inferred was that the dog had gone mad and was destroying the child. Whereas, but for the beast's intelligence, its reason, I tell you, the child would have perished. They disputed and disputed, and I was the very center and subject of it all. And I wished my mother could know that this grand honor had come to me. It would have made her proud. Then they discussed optics, as they called it, and whether a certain injury to the brain would produce blindness or not. But they could not agree about it and said they must test it by experiment by and by. And next they discussed plants, and that interested me because in summer, Sadie and I had planted seeds. I helped her dig the holes, you know. And after days and days, a little shrub or a flower came up there, and it was a wonder how that could happen. But it did, and I wished I could talk. I would have told those people about it and shown them how much I knew and been all alive with the subject, but I didn't care for the optics. It was dull, and when they came back to it again, it bored me, and I went to sleep. Pretty soon, it was spring, and sunny and pleasant and lovely, and the sweet mother and the children patted me and the puppy goodbye and went away on a journey and a visit to their kin, and the master wasn't any company for us, but we played together and had good times, and the servants were kind and friendly, so we got along quite happily and counted the days and waited for the family. And one day those men came again and said now for the test, and they took the puppy to the laboratory. And I limped three-leggedly along, too, feeling proud, for any attention shown the puppy was a pleasure to me, of course. They discussed and experimented, and then suddenly the puppy shrieked, and they set him on the floor, and he went staggering around with his head all bloody, and the master clapped his hands and shouted, there, I've won, confess it, he's as blind as a bat. And they all said, it's so, you've proved your theory, and suffering humanity owes you a great debt from henceforth. and they crowded around him and wrung his hand cordially and thankfully and praised him. But I hardly saw or heard these things, for I ran at once to my little darling and snuggled close to it where it lay and licked the blood, and it put its head against mine, whimpering softly, and I knew in my heart it was a comfort to it in its pain and trouble to feel its mother's touch, though it could not see me. Then it drooped down presently, and its little velvet nose rested upon the floor, and it was still and did not move any more. Soon the master stopped discussing a moment and ran in the footman and said, "Bury it in the far corner of the garden," and then went on with the discussion. And I trotted after the footman, very happy and grateful, for I knew the puppy was out of its pain now, because it was asleep. We went far down the garden to the furthest end, where the children and the nurse and the puppy and I used to play in the summer in the shade of a great elm. And there the footman dug a hole, and I saw he was going to plant the puppy, and I was glad, because it would grow and come up a fine, handsome dog, like Robin Adar, and be a beautiful surprise for the family when they came home. So I tried to help him dig, but my lame leg was no good, being stiff, you know, and you have to have two or it's no use. When the footman had finished and covered little Robin up, he patted my head, and there were tears in his eyes, and said, "Poor little doggie, you saved his child. I have watched 2 whole weeks, and he doesn't come up. This last week, a fright has been stealing upon me. I think there is something terrible about this. I do not know what it is, but the fear of it makes me sick. And I cannot eat, though the servants bring me the best of food, and they pet me so, and even come in the night and cry and say, 'Poor doggie, do give it up and come home. Don't break our hearts.' And all this terrifies me the more and makes me sure something has happened. And I am so weak. Since yesterday, I cannot stand on my feet any more. And within this hour, the servants, looking toward the sun where it was sinking out of sight, and the night chill coming on, said things I could not understand, but they carried something cold to my heart. Those poor creatures, they do not suspect. They will come home in the morning and eagerly ask for the little doggie that did the brave deed. And who of us will be strong enough to say the truth to them? The humble little friend is gone. Where go the beasts that perish?" I'm so sorry I couldn't get through that without sounding ridiculously emotional, but it's really sad to me. So I hope you enjoyed the story. I think it's quite lovely and certainly evokes some powerful images and emotions. So thank you for listening. For the animals, this is Colleen with Compassionate Cooks.